there's a job opening.
During the morning, I interviewed and met with four potential justices of our great Supreme Court.
And the candidates?
They are outstanding people.
Highly regarded as a rising star.
Has been clear about how religion plays in her decisions.
They are really incredible people.
And we don't know how they would vote when given that opportunity.
Donald Trump is going to meet with these people as long as they don't personally offend him or insult him.
In so many different ways, academically and every other way.
Overturn Roe v. Wade would not be acceptable to me.
You can throw a dart at that list. In my view, you'd be fine.
I had a very, very interesting morning.
Lots of different thoughts on the front runners, but it's not over yet.
I'll be meeting with two or three more.
And a decision is imminent, according to the president. But regardless of who he picks, President Trump feels good about his options.
I think the person that is chosen will be outstanding. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Walter, filling in for my colleague Tanzina Vega on this Thursday edition of the show. So who will be the next Supreme Court justice, a person with the potential to shape policy in the country for decades to come? To help me with this massive question, I've got Joe Patrice, editor of Above the Law, a legal news website. He is with me here in the studio.
Hi.
Hey, Joe. All right, let's start with this. There's a lot of speculation right now about some front runners for this job. Can you walk us through who you think is really in contention?
Well, I think there are two big names. There are several who could easily still be in contention because, like all game shows, there could be a switch at the end. But the two who really are coalescing as the favorites are Brett Kavanaugh, who's the D.C. Circuit judge, which, to use a sports analogy, the D.C. Circuit is the farm league for the Supreme Court. They deal with the big issues that often end up at the court. Lots of federal government cases run through there, so it's seen as a proving ground. He's got a lot of experience there. He's been on that court for 12 years now. Honestly, those of us who follow this a lot thought he was going to be the guy when it was Gorsuch. This is a person who's checked every box that you need to be a conservative Supreme Court justice. Elite education. Chuck Schumer once called him the Zelig of legal politics. He was part of the Ken Starr investigation. He was part of the Florida recount, worked in the Bush administration, just every single thing you could do.
And yet some of the rumors coming out of Washington are that social conservatives think he's not conservative enough, that if they really want to see somebody who's going to be a little more forward moving on issues like the Affordable Care Act, dismantling the Affordable Care Act, or on abortion.
Yeah. Whether those claims are cynical or real, I'll get a little bit into too. But with the Affordable Care Act thing, he had some decisions on that where he kind of said, well, this looks legal. But he was saying that as a circuit court judge, not as a Supreme Court justice. I think a lot of us think had he had that power, he would have said, well, obviously this is unconstitutional. But he didn't really have that power then. But that's a thing that they're focusing on, because I think a lot of social conservatives just don't want him, and they feel that this painting him as a swamp monster is what's really going on. A campaign to say, yeah, he's got all of these check marks that you would need to be an establishment right-wing figure. That's a bad thing. And you get Fox and Friends to say that to the president five or six times, and then maybe he'll give the job to who they really want, which is mostly Amy Coney Barrett, it looks like.
And why do they like her? Tell us about who she is.
Well, one thing they like is she's incredibly young for a judge. She's 46. She just got on the court. She doesn't have a long paper trail of judicial decisions, but she is a law professor before this. She's very right-wing, she became kind of a cause celeb for the right-wing because Dianne Feinstein asked some questions that got into her fairly dogmatic past. She'd written some stuff for law reviews about how, as a Catholic, maybe you should recuse yourself from certain decisions because church dogma would not allow you to make those decisions. Feinstein raised that as an issue.
When you read your speeches, the conclusion one draws is that the dogma lives loudly within you. And that's of concern.
It then got blown up into, why are you attacking somebody's religion? Not sure that's what she was doing, but nonetheless, that made Barrett kind of a star. But the real issue between the two of them, I think, is right after Kennedy's retirement announcement, there was some flurry of worry. And Mark Joseph Stern wrote this article that I largely agree with, where he said, Roe isn't going to get overturned. What's going to happen is a death of a thousand cuts. There'll be a new justice. And what will happen is Mississippi will pass a, you can only get an abortion in the first 24 hours or some restriction like that. They'll say that seems fine under Roe to them. And that's how it would be handled. There wouldn't be a real overruling. It would just be whittled away. I think what's going on here is the social conservatives see in Barrett the opportunity to actually overrule this case. They think that can happen, and they think that's who they want to do it. In a good way, you could say they do that. They want that for the optics. They don't want a landmark decision of women's rights to be overturned by five men voting. More cynically, I'm not sure that's really the reason. I think they want this landmark decision to be overruled and the opinion written by a woman to own the libs in the parlance of our times. But whether that's whatever justification they have for it, that's what they want.
There is something, though, too, about the fact that she is a woman. And we've been, again, hearing sort of in the rumor mill that that is something that the president would like to see happen as well. It certainly softens the case for him, for somebody who's been seen as someone who's not particularly, you know, good at promoting women. Are there other women in the mix that are considered serious?
Yeah. Joan Larson, who's on the Sixth Circuit, she used to be a Michigan Supreme Court justice. She's been discussed. From what we can tell, he's met with her or at least called her from what we're hearing. She doesn't have a ton of stuff to point to. She's very, very new to the federal courts. She was only on the Michigan Supreme Court to fill out a term, so she was only there briefly. But as far as we can tell, conservative in the conservative mold, but not generating the same sort of buzz because she's seen more establishment, I think, by a lot of folks than Barrett, who is, for whatever reason, has become the lightning rod that the social conservatives are around. And the other one that just came up, I just saw today for the first time, is Britt Grant, who's Georgia Supreme Court justice, who's currently in the process of being confirmed for an 11th Circuit seat. But there's some talk that maybe the president might want to shift her into this job. That came out of left field from my perspective. She would be, that would be if you really think the president's logic is, I want to dominate the court for decades to come, because she's 40, which is incredibly young for a judge.
For a Supreme Court justice. Yeah. We also know that this president likes surprises, right? And to sort of make this
a game show.
Yeah, to keep the suspense going. So there's a possibility that it may be somebody that we're not talking about?
Yeah, could easily be somebody we're not talking about. I think we've developed a pretty good list of the people in the discussion. While I think those two that we talked about first are the big two right now, Judge Kethledge has been kicked around quite a bit in this discussion. Also, Sixth Circuit judge in Michigan, well-liked by everybody around him, considered kind of a Gorsuch 2.0, a kind of under-the-radar conservative who's not as nearly as involved in everything as Kavanaugh or as flashy to the right as Barrett is, but just a kind of steady, good, conservative, solid person. And Hardiman, who was the runner-up last time, he's a very conservative judge from the Third Circuit, which is the Pennsylvania area. He's being lobbied for a bit by Rick Santorum. He's kind of more in the Alito mold in my mind. He's got a great story. He worked his way through school by driving a cab, but he very kind of dogmatic Second Amendment. He has some First Amendment cases that are in line with the current conservative worldview of abortion rights activists don't get First Amendment rights. Schools don't get them, but protesters of abortion do, and campaign finance does. Like, he has that kind of line on the First Amendment that people have talked about. So he would be more dogmatic, I think, and flashy than some, but for whatever reason, still not generating the buzz that Barrett is.
Let's talk about this process for a minute. We have talked about this as if, you know, we are analyzing, I don't know, whether, like, in a sort of sports parlance, right? Who are front runners? Who has the best batting average? Whatever. Is this normal, what we're doing, how we're going through this process, and how quickly this seems to be coming together?
Oh, absolutely not. There's nothing normal about any of this. No, but usually a Supreme Court justice pick takes around a month to get named, usually involves a process of vetting that starts over anew every time there's a vacancy to really dig down into what's going on. And it's never set with an arbitrary deadline because previous administrations take it very seriously and will announce when they're ready to announce. this was set with a deadline that it'll be done on July 9th. And that way, this entire week can be only about that, not about any other issue that's going on that could be plaguing the president's poll numbers. And we're just going to do that and have a big announcement. And we're going to have leaks all week about this horse race. And it's good TV, which is kind of part of this administration's, you know, that's their strong suit, is to try and create suspense and drama. And that's what they're doing. And what we'll have now is we'll have this run through very quickly. In some sense, it's okay for them to go quickly because, unlike a lot of previous administrations, this one said very early on they were only going to take judges off of this list that currently has 25 names on it. This list that's compiled by a conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, and the Federalist Society, which is a conservative law school group, which basically keeps tabs on people from the moment they enter law school through their whole career to see if they're really dedicated conservatives. And this being so vetted and so worked out by these folks means that it's not like a usual situation where you have to dig into what's going on. They've been doing it. They've been tracking this in real time.
And that the idea that you could have someone who is nominated and we'll find out a lot of surprises about them, that's also unlikely, yeah, right? Because they've been vetted through this process. So yeah, there's not going to be a whoop.
Yeah. The Justice Souter situation where that, I mean, that nomination, to go back in history, was more or less out of the blue. There was no reason to put him on the Supreme Court. John Sununu was a friend of Bush and was like, this guy's from New Hampshire. I like New Hampshire people. That's really the whole logic of putting Souter there. And when Souter turned out to be way more liberal than they thought, it surprised them. This is a different generation. Now we've had a couple of decades of the Federalist Society and of these people tracking everything their members do to advance the cause. So we're not going to see somebody come out of left field and be a, you know, closeted liberal. It's going to be somebody who really is a true believer either way, which is part of the reason why it's so weird that there are these conservatives who have it in for Kavanaugh, because he has crossed off all of those barriers. He really is the conservative that they probably should want.
Joe Patrice is editor at Above the Law, a legal news website. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks.
If you have any thoughts on the upcoming SCOTUS pick, and who are we kidding? Everybody does. Tweet me at Amy E. Walter or at The Takeaway.
Whether you voted or didn't vote, this is your Kentucky. This is your America. This is our opportunity to come together as one.
In his race for governor in 2015, then-candidate Matt Bevin campaigned on rolling back Medicaid expansion and the state's Affordable Care Act insurance exchange. So it was no surprise when the now Governor Bevin tried to institute work requirements for Medicaid recipients. But last week, a federal judge blocked the governor's work requirement plan, and Bevin responded by cutting dental and vision coverage for around 460,000 Kentuckians. A few weeks ago, we dedicated an entire show to work requirements for government benefits, so this story caught my eye. To get a better sense of what's happening on the ground in Kentucky, I spoke with Ryland Barton, a State House reporter for Kentucky Public Radio.
Over the last, you know, 2 to 5 years since Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act has rolled out in Kentucky, is this hasn't really become a big voting issue. So politically speaking, this hasn't turned into something where people have lost a great deal of benefits and in turn, voted somebody out of office for taking benefits away.
So then the Bevin administration asks the Trump administration for a waiver to say, if you're part of the Medicaid expansion universe, you need to show that either you're working or volunteering, you need to have some sort of evidence of that in order to get your Medicaid benefits. Is that right?
Right. And so it's either working, volunteering, being in school full time. You could also be taking care of somebody full time would count as this community engagement requirement. And you'd have to prove that on a monthly basis. And if you didn't, you'd be kicked off of it. And then there'd be opportunities to get back on by proving once again that you're working or volunteering et cetera. And then the other thing was paying monthly premiums between $1 and $15 a month. And also met vision and dental benefits were, they'd be elective. You would have to earn points to get vision and dental services by either volunteering or taking online classes or getting regular checkups. And that's something that was provided under Medicaid.
Now, this is just for the universe of people who were included under the expansion, or does this also include people who were covered previously, like children or pregnant women or disabled people?
So it includes people outside of the Medicaid expansion universe, as you put it, but it's still just it would only affect able-bodied people, as it's mm-hmm. phrased in the Medicaid expansion, and that's also exclusive of pregnant women, children. So even people in the traditional Medicaid coverage would have to pay monthly premiums, say, but they'd be much smaller. It'd be like about $1 a month in order to keep their coverage.
So the Trump administration said, okay, yeah, you can do this. And a judge, though, last week said, no, you can't. So what did the judge say?
The judge said that the point of Medicaid is for these Medicaid waivers is to improve health coverage. And I think the judge really questioned, and ultimately what the judge was doing is sending this back to the federal government for them to, you know, re-review this and come up with a better idea of how much coverage would be stripped from people. I think that's really what he was questioning, is whether the state could just fully take coverage away from these people who were previously covered. And what the people who are suing over this are arguing is that the Medicaid plan doesn't do anything to improve health coverage of people. And the state is saying that by requiring people to work, they're going to be paying more attention to their health coverage and using it and improving their health. And that's going to make them more engaged in their health outcomes. And the judge wasn't convinced by that. I think that the judge wanted to know, exactly who is going to be kicked off and why they would be kicked off Medicaid over the next 5 years.
So what was Bevin's reaction to this lawsuit?
The first, very quickly after the ruling, he immediately stripped vision and dental benefits from people within the Medicaid expansion population in Kentucky. So that's about 460,000 people who previously got vision and dental coverage and will no longer. And the state says that it's because, they've been planning on this and that they're not going to be able to afford to provide these benefits without the changes that would have gone forward through the waiver.
So what does this mean if I were in that Medicaid universe and I have a dental procedure scheduled for this upcoming week? Does that mean I can't go through with it?
Yeah, if you're within that expansion population, you would not be able to use your Medicaid coverage to pay for that. And actually, we saw a couple days ago, the Louisville Courier Journal had a story about how some of these changes had gone far beyond the Medicaid expansion population. There's some problems in which people who are supposed to have vision and Medicaid and dental benefits and are in the traditional Medicaid population have lost them. And even children have been showing up to the dentist's office and not being able to pay for their coverage using Medicaid. This is kind of an ongoing thing we've seen in Kentucky over the last couple of years, some problems with the eligibility system that the state uses, especially when they're making big changes. It's had some pretty deep glitches.
So I've read that some Democrats and those who are opposed to what Governor Bevin has done with cutting the benefits are saying it's illegal to do this. You can't just abruptly cut benefits. What do we know about whether this is true or not? And what recourse do people who are opposed to what the governor is doing have right now?
Right. That's kind of the next step we're waiting for, is to see if any advocates or Medicaid beneficiaries will sue to try and keep the governor's recent changes that stripping vision and dental benefits away. There's some question whether or not they'd have to apply to the federal government in order to strip vision and dental benefits before they could just change that. We'll see if that comes up. Certainly, vision and dental, it's kind of optional coverage within Medicaid. It's something that the state didn't have to provide, but there's just some question whether or not they could so abruptly remove it. I mean, it was something that, was offered on Friday, June 29th, and then no longer offered on Sunday, July 1st.
Ryland Barton is the State House reporter for Kentucky Public Radio. Ryland, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you're interested in learning more about this issue, check out our whole show called Who Deserves Work Requirements. You can find it online at thetakeaway.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Leadership in America. What does it look like? Do you trust it? What makes for great leaders in tumultuous times? These are some of the questions we'll be asking on tomorrow's program as we focus on the topic of leadership, the series of conversations I had at the Aspen Ideas Festival last week. Today, we'll bring you one piece of that coverage. While in Aspen, I sat down with Deborah Fallows, a linguist and contributor to The Atlantic, and her husband, James Fallows, a national correspondent for The Atlantic. Their new book is Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America.
So this was actually 2013 when we first revved up the plane and headed out to get the pulse, to talk to the people, to see what was going on in the non-big coastal towns in America.
Deborah and James told me that understanding what people look for in leaders means stepping away from national politics.
For a good, what, Jim, 2.5, 3 years, we didn't talk national politics at all.
Our premise was always, tell us what is the story of Sioux Falls. You know, why are people moving here? Why are they leaving? What's getting better? What's getting worse? How are the schools? What kind of industries do you have here? And partly it was because we just, that's what we were interested in. But also we learned over time that the very least enlightening thing you can possibly do when going to a town in America is what 99% of our colleagues do, which is say, how do you feel about Trump? You know, do you like Hillary? How crooked is she? Because there's two things wrong with that. One is nothing they can say will be surprising in any way. It's just what you've seen from talk shows. And number two, it shrinks all the dimensions of their life to this just flattened grid of Trump versus Hillary 2 years ago or Obama after that. And the actual life there is so much richer and more complicated and generally more positive.
Well, and the other narrative, certainly post-2016, was in the middle of America, it is one of two things, a hollowed out hellscape where industry has fled, the global economy has left people behind, and or two, that these are people who are angry and frustrated at the elites who have left them behind and they're here to take their country back.
So Deb is from there. So you're from Ohio. So I'll give my not from Ohio. I'm from sort of a version of the Midwest that happens to be in California, from interior California, which was a town called Redlands. This was settled by people back in the Dust Bowl era. They would come, you know, from the South and Midwest, and before that from the Northeast. So on the hellscape front, what we saw, we went to places that had had a lot of problems, you know, like Erie, Pennsylvania, which has had all of its deindustrialization, and places in the Dakotas, which were dealing with drought, and San Bernardino, California, which has a zillion problems. And everybody was aware of the problems they had. And the question, the thing which mainly struck us in contrast to the national mood is that most places, most people felt as if they were moving in a good rather than bad direction. It wasn't a sinking ship with everybody sort of shooting all survivors. It was awareness of problems from opioids to new industries. You know, in Mississippi, we're in Kentucky, all of, so it didn't seem like a hellscape unless you asked, who do you hate more of the national candidates? Then you could get this hellscape rhetoric.
And the idea of seething anger out there was nothing that came to our awareness or consciousness until it seemed to be kind of conjured up in the national scene and in the quote national conversation. When we'd go to towns, people weren't waiting around for the government to do something great for them or to bail them out if things were bad or to even create something new if things were kind of okay. They were acting from their local needs and experience and assets to take charge and make things happen in a way that would help solve some of their problems, like the mill closed or the mine closed, and do it on terms that made sense for where they were locally and where they could individually have an impact in whatever they chose to act on, sense of power locally.
The way I try to reconcile these things is to say, at the national level, I think we're in a genuine time of crisis, that there has not been a national leader like the one we have now before, and that many of the worst eras in American political history, notably the late 1800s, were recapitulating now. So there is a national problem that really merits first-order attention. Simultaneously, you have the parts of the country that are not directly affected by national politics are in a period of renewal, experimentation, reinvention, diverse possibilities around the country. And I think the main historical model from which I try to draw consolation is the late 19th, early 20th centuries, sort of the seeds of the progressive and populist era, where you also had bad national politics sometimes. And you had these people all across the country with the women's movement and the the suffrage movement and the environmental movement and the black rights movement, all these things. And so I am hoping that in this struggle between paralysis at the top and reinvention at the bottom, the reinventing forces can be given more airtime.
So overall, do you think that we are in a crisis of leadership in this country?
On which level?
That's it. That's what I'm saying. So the narrative is there's a crisis of leadership at the national level.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I don't know that there may be a frustration, at least I'm hearing that too, that the people who could come and solve it, who have leadership traits, don't want to engage in it.
Because, who would really want to run for Congress right now? I hope and pray that talented people do, but it's a challenging thing to prospect. But again, I'm not in the prediction business, but I will predict this. We've seen so many young mayors and business leaders and librarians and NGO people of all races, both genders, every sort of background you want, even different generations, but mainly young, who embody this sense of we're better than the national politics of this moment. And I think that one of these people or several of them will appear, maybe not 2 years from now, maybe 6 years from now, and this person's story will have an effect as presidential candidates do appear. Jimmy Carter, for whom I worked, appeared out of nowhere. Obama, in a different way, appeared in 2004 out of nowhere. Somebody will appear and people say, yes, that's what we've been looking for, somebody who has that story, that voice.
On the local level, I think there's a surplus of leadership. And you never quite know. When we went into Eastport, Maine, or St. Mary's, Georgia, who were the leaders there? They could be teachers. They could be the mayor. They could be business people, founding fathers. There was no definition of who the leader would be. But it was someone who saw the potential of their community and had enough charisma or standing to rally people around into action and to get people to follow. And it wasn't necessarily just a leader. It might have been a group of leaders, like the millennials in San Bernardino, California, who are really driving a new civic engagement. How that translates into state representation and national government, I'm not sure. It's funny, I didn't get the sense that people who were the leaders locally were positioning themselves politically for a step up, whether they'll feel that obligation once they have traction where they are, or, they'll time out as mayor and think, what's next? There are a lot of ways that could happen.
Deb Fallows, Jim Fallows, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Amy. Yeah.
Deborah Fallows is a linguist and contributor to The Atlantic. James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. Their book is called Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America. More on American leadership tomorrow. In a time where fake news, online bots, and foreign meddling are genuine concerns for the American public, conversations about the health of our democracy feel real and important. The first edition of A Documentary History of the United States was published in 1952, highlighting the essential documents, speeches, and letters that ultimately shaped American history. Now, A Documentary History has been updated for a 10th time, with a new chapter that includes, you guessed it, tweets and Facebook posts alongside notable speeches and statements. With us today is Alexander Heffner, the co-author of this book and host of The Open Mind on PBS. His new chapter in this edition, Populists Revolt, Democracy Under Duress, challenges us to look at changes in American politics in the digital era. Hi, Alexander. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Amy. A pleasure to be with you.
I am really happy to have you here. So here's your 10th edition of the book, and you write a final chapter that uses very different types of primary sources to show what American democracy in the modern era looks like. So tell us what separates this chapter from the others.
I think one of the things that separates it is we have technology now being exploited for malicious purposes, and we were talking about this just a second ago. It's this noxious fusion of the hyper-partisan climate and the absence of context and the absence of a thoroughness and a commitment to the greater good. And I know that's what you pride yourself on here and we do on public media. But these social media, they're really anti-social media in the way that they disseminate information, which is often dis or misinformation, and they degrade our core democratic fiber. So in this 10th edition, we include Zuckerberg's Facebook post, which we're owning up to the fact that, yes, Facebook played a role in furthering, spreading the fake news. And in the same breath, we include Donald Trump's tweets, regrettably, because they speak to both the message, the vitriol, the vindictiveness, the viciousness of this political moment. And they also speak to the medium, the newness, the novelty of Twitter as that modern day bully pulpit.
But wasn't that the goal of technology? Isn't that the really at its core, the fact that technology can bring people closer to the actual quote unquote truth? In other words, you don't need anyone to filter things for you anymore. You can go directly to the source, the original. Now you can get PDFs easily. You don't have to go down to a library or an archive. You can live stream rallies or speeches. You don't have to wait for the news media to give it to you. So why technology then? You're calling it sort of this noxious fume, but at its best, can't it actually help make democracy better?
That was the aspiration. But we're looking at in real time the consequence of that aspiration, the digitization, the democratization of our body politic. You would think that common spaces, a virtual public square like Twitter or Facebook, could be – the output of that could be pro-social growth, consensus, building bridges. But the leadership of those websites, especially during the 16 campaign and the run-up to it, abdicated all responsibility. And they said, we're not journalists. We're merely moderators. And sometimes we're not even moderators. So the end game of this democratization has been electing demagogues, not just here in this country, but around the world.
So it really democratized the process because it's literally going directly to people versus somebody, you know, having some sort of leadership role in making it work.
Right. I think you elect demagogues when you amuse yourself to death, to cite Neil Postman, may he rest in peace. The idea of democracy is that we have to be informed citizens. So we see examples in this 10th edition of A Documentary History of the United States of those speeches that are restoring or still committed to integrity in discourse. And you know, in that sense, Jeff Flake and Bernie Sanders' speeches, which are much more in the traditional mold of political oratory, are committed to those values of being honest, of being forthright, and of also, I think Flake more than Sanders, committing yourself to a complicated idea of America, that it is not just greatness in and of itself, that we have to look at the means and the end. And in this case, even for conservatives who were on the never Trump bandwagon, they, I think, are wrestling every day with this idea that to what end are we putting jurists on the bench if Donald Trump's authoritarian impulse is bleeding onto judges? It's what difference is it then in a Pinochet regime when you handpick judges and say, yes, that's my jurist. My jurist is going to be very good for me. So we live in a usually difficult time to reconcile these democratic values.
But haven't we always lived in these really difficult times? America's been polarized for a most of our history, just at times sure. more, is, think, more than others. So what makes this different, especially thinking back into this book and all of the documents that you've gone through, what makes this time different or maybe not so different from where we've been before?
I think it is very different. And I'll give you one example that I think you'll appreciate. Could you imagine Mike Pence at this juncture giving a speech like Gerald Ford did in his inaugural address amid that tumult, that turbulent time for our democracy, and saying it's the truth that binds us as a civilization and a government? I couldn't envision that. I feel like he's sold himself to Trumpism, and Trump in turn has sold himself to the extremist of the extreme orthodoxy, that we live in a different moment where we elected someone who has 30% of faithful followers and 60 to 70% are not represented. And we live in this minoritarian culture where it was not just the Electoral College, but now through gerrymandering, these institutions are rigged against the voter. So I think there are differences institutionally in the way that we vote, in the way that we govern, that are noteworthy.
But it's not just people on the right that are using technology. People on the left, you talked about Bernie Sanders in your book, and you compare and contrast both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump as populists who use technology to promote themselves. We've seen this most recently in congressional elections where folks are able to harness the power of the internet to talk directly to people. Is it different somehow for Bernie Sanders being able to use the power of technology than it is for somebody like Donald Trump? They're both promoting a populist power to the people agenda.
It's true. I think the fact that we indicate, and Daniel Dale does this at the Toronto Star, the extent to which this president lies on social media makes it different from Bernie Sanders' use. I mean, it's just a difference in terms of whether or not we can rely on our commander-in-chief to be factual. And so from that perspective, I think that Bernie Sanders was not fact-checked ad nauseum in the same way Donald Trump has really committed himself to unearthing these conspiracy theories and exploiting them for the betterment of his narrow political ideological agenda. So in that respect, I think it's different. And the Republicans have capitalized on Trump's cult-like persona online. And Bernie Sanders, while he won millions of votes during the primaries and caucus season, in the end of the day, you know, he just couldn't capitalize on his personality. And I think you need a more expansive definition of what your constituency is in 2020.
Alexander Heffner is the host of Open Mind on PBS. He's also a campus speaker and journalist and co-author of the updated A Documentary History of the United States. Alexander, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Amy.
And that's it for our show today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Amy Walter, filling in for Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.